Hey friends, I want to thank our sponsor, Raygun. Are you struggling to replicate the bugs and performance issues that your customers are reporting? Plug Raygun into your web and mobile applications right now and diagnose problems in minutes rather than hours. Kiss goodbye having to dig through log files and relying on frustrated users to report issues. Make your software development life so much easier using Raygun's error, crash, and performance monitoring tools. Every software team can create flawless software experiences for their customers with Raygun. Try it free today at raygun.com. That's R-A-Y-G-U-N.com. Friends, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Melanie Ensign. She's the head of security and privacy communications at Uber, but more importantly, she's a shark diver. How are you?
I'm good, Scott. Thank you so much for having me.
I love your Twitter, but it's a very interesting mix between, like, you know, privacy and security and like DEF CON type stuff and sharks. What's with the sharks?
Yeah, so I actually started college as a marine biology major. It's from a really young age as a kid, I wanted to be a shark scientist. And so while it is not what I ended up doing professionally, it is still a really big part of my life. And, you know, folks who do follow me on Twitter will get to see all kinds of like photos and videos from the shark dives that I do from time to time. It's kind of my way to recharge and take a break and when I need a vacation from all of the security and privacy drama, swimming with sharks is far more relaxing.
The irony is thick, dealing with sharks online, and then I need to relax. I'm going to go and swim with some sharks.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the sharks in the ocean are far lower risk.
That is absolutely true. But so this is a hobby, but you didn't abandon your degree. Like, you're probably like doing low key amateur research on sharks.
I mean, I think so. I think I'm more following and learning from the research that all of my friends are doing, those that actually completed our program and went on to actually become, you know, PhDs in marine biology and ichthyology and those related fields. But I do draw a lot of experiences and insights from that time in my life and the research that's come out of that field in the way that I do my job now in terms of communications for security and privacy issues. Mm-hmm. So while I may not spend as much time in the ocean as I would like to on a day-to-day basis, like some of my friends who are professional researchers, I draw a lot from that field in the role that I do have now.
Mm-hmm. You were an adjunct professor at Boston University. You worked at Facebook. You worked with DEF CON for, you know, the world's largest hacker conference for many years. And now you're at Uber. What got you excited about kind of cybersecurity in general?
Morbid curiosity, I think, at first. But it wasn't a field that I intentionally went into. After I shifted away from marine biology, I started doing more kind of environmental communications and started getting into technology communications through kind of a field of corporate sustainability. Mm-hmm. And at the time that I, you know, entered the field, like software was coming into play in terms of doing environmental, like footprint analysis and things like that. So working with those types of companies from the beginning, I was kind of, you know, making kind of the step into the technology space. And through a chance kind of setup of different circumstances, I ended up working with the chief security office at AT&T for about 6 years. And wow. That's really where I cut my teeth in security, was working with their engineers, their product solutions team, understanding not just what engineers do in regards to security, but also businesses and companies in terms of how do they invest in this area from a product perspective and a procurement perspective. Mm-hmm. So I didn't seek out cybersecurity the way that, you know, a CS major might or a computer science major. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I started working with this team, it was almost kind of love at first sight. It hit all of the buttons that I had as a nerd growing up as a kid. You know, my dad did teach me to code when I was young. It was something that I really enjoyed doing. And so, you know, being able to see more of the behind the scenes of how some of these technologies and software that I was using as a consumer, how all of this was working was very interesting to me. And I was really intrigued by it. And at the same time, working in, you know, the field of security and privacy enabled me to do something that has always been really important to me, which is to help other people.
That's cool. And you found your tribe.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's a cause behind what a lot of us do, right? Mm-hmm. That we're not totally in this for ourselves. And that makes it, I think, a lot more sustainable in terms of the high pressure situations that many of us are in from time to time because of, you know, what we do for a living. And, you know, when you realize that you're part of something bigger, that really drives and motivates you.
How do companies, or how should companies, find balance between being secure and being private, but also like mining the data that they have? Like, I understand that I am the product when it comes to Facebook or Google or whatever. They look at every click, not actively, but they are the metadata that I am consuming by simply looking at a photo. We always have that creepy experience when you look at something on Amazon and then suddenly every website in the world wants to sell you that thing you looked at. I want to understand, like, security and privacy people are trying to lock things down, but I assume that the corporations are trying to open things up. Like, they want to look at that data, but you want to keep it private.
So I think, to be honest, I don't think it's a binary choice. I think there is a lot of options along that spectrum. And I think what companies are starting to realize now, And I think more folks in the community will realize it over time, is that there doesn't have to be this all or nothing experience. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, creating a product where people do have the option and the control to choose the experience that they're most comfortable with, I think is really where, you know, the smartest, most innovative companies are going. There's, you know, a number of tech companies who are, you know, in response to proposed privacy legislation and things, are, you know, bringing up the issue of innovation, you know, and whether or not all of these new laws and rules are going to hamper innovation, particularly in the technology sector. And the reality is in 2019, you can't have innovation without privacy. We simply should not be accepting technology that doesn't have privacy protections in it as a standard of innovation. And so, you know, a lot of where I think the new innovation is going to come from is, you know, more along, like I said, along this spectrum and giving people more choices so that you can use some of these platforms or other tools in the way that suits your needs and where you have more choice and control up front about what data is collected, what it's used for. And I think part of this also reflects the growing awareness and public consciousness of this issue. 10 years ago, people were willing to, you know, to say yes to something because they didn't particularly understand the risks that were involved. And so, you know, when we first signed up for, you know, like a social media account or an Amazon account, you know, it was more of, I think, what we can think of in that traditional sense of like, am I willing to trade my data for this convenience or for this service? And fortunately, we're now getting to the point, not just with companies, but as a society, where we can have a more sophisticated and nuanced conversation about what types of conveniences do you want, right? So again, moving away from that all or nothing model and creating more options so that, you know, somebody who is comfortable or who perceives value or trade-offs a little bit differently can go to one end of the spectrum if they want. But I think most of us are actually going to fall somewhere in the middle, right? Where, you know, I'm okay giving Amazon parts of my information because, you know, of the service or experience that I have with them. That doesn't necessarily mean that I'm comfortable with them sharing it with all of their partners, right? And so I think we're, like I said, we're moving in what I think is a positive direction in terms of the level of sophistication that we're able to have in our conversations, not just as customers and consumers, but, you know, also with our policymakers and regulators. It's a trend that happened, you know, in other industries. It happened in security first, I think, and now privacy is following suit. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with the fact that privacy is moving out of just legal conversation. Mm-hmm. We used to talk all the time about how security was like coming out of the corners of the IT department and now becoming mainstream, right? And privacy is going through a similar evolution right now. You know, it's just that its origin started in the legal department.
Mm-hmm. It feels like one of the challenges with privacy and security, and I'm going to use them as a group for now, is the proactive versus the reactive, where everything's totally fine until one minute it's dramatically and catastrophically not fine. Like, I might have a slider bar that describes my privacy preference, like we're talking about, and my non-technical parent might set that privacy bar somewhere, but then something happens that makes them feel gross. And then they immediately flip out because of a lack of understanding, a lack of education. How do we build controls and systems such that we don't always take a gradient, like you described, and flip it into a binary? Because like you say, it's great until it's totally not great. I didn't know you knew that about me. And now I'm upset.
Sure. So I think, you know, the way that you describe this in terms of being proactive is exactly kind of the remedy here. And I don't mean proactive in terms of just offering that slider bar or that setting, right? Like there are companies and platforms that have dozens and dozens of privacy settings. that is really overwhelming for the average consumer. To just look at this laundry list of options, some of them you may not even understand. And so we think part of, you know, this notion of being proactive about that has to do with first understanding what the expectations of your users and customers are. Mm-hmm. If you can imagine, even in our personal lives, it's very jarring when somebody does something that seems out of character or when somebody doesn't live up to your expectations. You know, it's easy to get disappointed. It's easy to feel violated. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that we can, you know, that we experience or learn in our interpersonal relationships that also apply to the relationship that companies and brands have with their customers. So it shouldn't surprise us that, you know, my friends or family, you know, may feel uncomfortable when I do something that seems out of character, in the same way that my customers may get really uncomfortable if, you know, my company or my team does something that they didn't expect from us, right? And so there's a lot of just foundational and fundamental things in terms of human interaction and communication that is now being applied in the technology space, and bringing in a lot more expertise from other disciplines other than just the strict engineering or product development track, right? I mean, I do not have a technical background. Like I said, I started in marine biology. My master's degree is in communications. This is, you know, different disciplines who understand different aspects of humanity who are coming into tech to say, you know, we have some information, we have some knowledge that can actually help you be better at what you're trying to do.
You bring up a really interesting point, because I've been writing about interpersonal relationships, and I'm starting to figure out obvious things that I think we've all figured out, is that when expectations are not met, that's when anger and fear kind of happen. Like if I understood ahead of time that XYZ thing was going to happen, then I would feel some kind of way, but I was surprised. And it's right. That surprise, it's that email that, oh, all my information at this hotel chain is now public. Wow, that does not meet my expectations.
Yeah, I mean, like, who knew that Marriott was actually holding on to all of those passport numbers for that long?
I thought they just wanted it so I could check in. They don't need it after.
Yep. And so, you know, this is, you know, these companies that are a little bit more forward thinking and really focusing on their customers and the expectations of their users, you know, having a pulse on what their expectations are and how they feel about certain things. Mm-hmm. You know, I have conversations with my teams all the time where I'm like, look, our customers don't expect that we have this information or that we're doing this certain thing with it. So why are we? right? And it, yeah. it puts more onus on the technical teams to justify all of that behavior. And in some cases, you know, that is enough feedback for them to say, you know, you're absolutely right. Let's just kill it.
Right.
And then, you know, the project goes away or the collection goes away. I mean, we've removed a number of features, even within our own mobile app, based on, you know, feedback from our users on their expectations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so again, you have to proactively understand who you're building things for. And what they're expecting from you.
Well, not to put you on the spot too much, but you had a great tweet, one of those real talk type tweets, where you said, it's not engineers who cause the worst privacy issues, it's MBAs. Mm-hmm. And now you certainly have to, you know, go, you know, move seamlessly between the business people and the technical people. But why do you say that? Why is it that the MBAs might inadvertently or fully verdantly make the worst privacy issues?
I think a lot of it is because they don't always understand what it is they're asking for. And so they look at a business problem or a business challenge, you know, from the perspective of how can I solve this through a certain lens. And you know, to be honest, right now, like the big thing that like everybody in B school seems to be graduating with is this like obsession with data, as if data is the fix all for everything.
Well, mine it all, right? Mine it and mine it some more.
And if like volumes of data inherently bring more value, right? Like having a lot of data really doesn't help your business at all if you don't know how to analyze it and use it properly.
Right.
Just and then you're just paying to store it and protect it and secure it. And then you have these situations where catastrophes happen. And so I think just a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, a lot of MBAs will not necessarily even end up being for like that particular tree. I wasn't even necessarily thinking about like executives. I'm thinking about like product managers. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, the folks who think they, you know, they're just kind of solving problems through like a more narrow lens.
Mm-hmm.
Engineers I have found are very aware of what data is being collected, where right. it's going, what it's being used for, because they work in these systems day to day. And so in my experience working with engineers, all I have to do is give them the guidance of here's what you can do, here's what you can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And they can build the systems to meet those requirements. But you know, for the folks who have different success metrics, I think a lot of it just has to do with they don't really understand the consequences of what they're asking for, or what has to be built, or what, you know, actual practices will come out of those expectations.
Hey, folks, you're a very good developer, probably. Regardless, you do write bugs. That's unavoidable. What is avoidable is wasting time trying to track down the cause of those bugs. Sentry.io provides full-stack error tracking that lets you monitor and fix problems in real time. You can see the severity and the scope of the error, get immediate access to the stack trace, connect the problem to the commit that caused it, and fix it without delay. Sentry, it's a name so common that they have to include the top-level domain in their advertising to make sure you remember it. Sentry.io. That's Sentry.io. Open source, full stack, web apps, native apps, mobile games, smart oven mitts. If you can program it, they can make it far easier to fix any errors you encounter with it. Your code may be broken. Let's fix it together. Visit Sentry.io. It feels like a lot of startups basically start with a perspective of just log everything, get telemetry on everything, and we'll figure out what's important or what's useful later, because everyone clicks the EULA when they sign up early on, and no one really goes back and reasserts that EULA as things change in the future. So open, you know, kind of open by default and unlimited telemetry by default can kind of lull us into a sense of security and things are okay when huge amounts of data are being logged that just really never were asked for or needed.
Right, exactly. I mean, so I think there's two distinct things here. Is there are certainly services and apps who are, and I think the New York Times had a really good example of this a couple of months ago with their story about these apps that were collecting location data, but they weren't actually like location-based apps, right? They were just collecting location data and then kind of becoming like a data broker for those things and selling that information to other parties.
Right.
And again, to your earlier point, that surprised a lot of people. They were not expecting that, you know, this flashlight app is collecting, you know, location data. But there's also the expectation and realm where, you know, people would be expecting location data to be collected, but, you know, for example, by a company who's actually like, you know, providing that transportation.
Yeah.
But there's the conversation in the industry, at least with those of us who do this full time inside companies, is no, we don't expect that anyone is actually reading terms of service, right? It's just not for human consumption, to be honest.
Right.
And so we're thinking about creating more of like security and privacy that you can actually feel in your experience of using the product.
Right.
So instead of just, you know, having, you know, this contractual consent process when you first create, you know, your account or first use an app, thinking about what are you doing in the app and what are the moments that matter in that experience where we could surface some of this information and help you make a more informed decision.
Right.
So, you know, it's not just like the one and done of when you create an account, but we actually want this to be part of the user experience, so that there aren't any surprises. And so that, you know, in those moments where you have the opportunity to make a choice, mm-hmm. that you're aware that that choice exists and that, you know, you're given the tools and the information in order to take action based on your preferences.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the term the uncanny valley when it comes to 3D rendering of faces?
I am not.
May I explain really briefly?
Sure.
So this is where like, hey, that's a cute robot. It's like WALL-E. And then like, oh, wow, that robot has a face. That's cute. Oh, my God, that looks like a zombie. Like as you start to render things and they look like more and more like people, there's a moment when it's like, look at the dead.
It's creepy.
It's got dead eyes. And then it suddenly becomes amazing again, right? There's an uncanny valley of privacy and security when it comes to things like artificial intelligence, where it's like, oh, that's delightful. Oh, that's so cool. Like, oh my goodness, they're putting different faces on my Netflix album art because they know what I've been looking at. And now they're trying to make me click on movies that suck. I've just fallen into the uncanny valley of privacy. Like I get why they want to know stuff, but then there's a moment it's like, oh, that went way too far. I think we're still as an industry trying to figure out what that uncanny valley of privacy is.
Well, and I think that there's, I mean, some of those examples, I think, are more about companies building features and tools in order to collect more data versus thinking about what data would make the service better and building something that is worthwhile for the user.
Right.
Based on that data. There is, unfortunately, you know, pockets of technology companies where they're thinking about, you know, we really want this data set over here that we don't currently collect. What can we build?
Yeah,
that in order find to it for get us. That data.
Oh my God, right?
And so it's backwards, right? Yeah, and so, yeah. You know, the privacy and security teams are sitting down with product teams and engineers to say, there needs to be a justification for this feature from the user perspective first. We're not going to build a product for the purpose of collecting data. And that's a shift in the way that a lot of, you know, Silicon Valley companies have traditionally thought.
That is a really interesting way of thinking about it. And that's very helpful to me because I work on, you know, developer tools and we have this command line where people are typing in different commands and we collect anonymous telemetry. We're very explicit. It's all public about what we actually released the telemetry data back out to the customer about like, what are they typing at the command line? But we want to be careful that we don't catch like code names and, sure. You know, secret namespaces of people's projects and stuff. So, you know, what starts as a blacklist becomes a whitelist. And this is all very useful data that helps us improve the product. But that generic, by giving us your data, it helps us improve the product, is such a vagary. It doesn't feel like this is substantively making the product better. So you're saying invert the whole thing, flip it on its head and say, what can we collect specifically to make the product better now?
Well, do we need that to make the product better? In fact, I have a number of heart-to-heart conversations with folks all the time, not just at my own company, but, you know, across the industry where, you know, the conversation we're having is, first, I need you to justify to me that this problem can only be solved with more data. right? And again, it's, you know, this is where, again, I'm going back to the comment about MBAs is like data is not the answer for everything. And sometimes it's just a matter of you're not using the data you already have in a really smart way. So, you know, before we get to the point of what is the feature, you know, before we get to the conversation of what do we need to collect in order to enable this feature, mm-hmm. you know, the question is, prove to me that data is the only solution, right? That it's the only path. Because from my perspective, collecting more data in order to solve a problem should be, you know, last case scenario. We should have exhausted all of the alternatives before we assume that collecting data is going to be the answer.
So this sounds like a song that I want to sing, and I'm a fan. I like this perspective and this way of thinking. How do we, you know, build that into the ethos of everyone? And then how do you explain it to non-technical parent and, God help us, non-technical lawmaker?
So, you know, to be honest, I don't know if we can actually do that without building it into the product first. Mm-hmm. I know from a privacy perspective, there's, you know, some very vocal and valid criticisms in terms of, like, you know, some of the platform companies and social media companies. But one of the great things that we've gotten from all of those companies is massive awareness and visibility among consumers about security issues. Google made HTTPS a thing on the internet, right? I think some of the engagement that Facebook has done in their product has really increased awareness of things like two-factor authentication or, you know, using their trusted contacts feature so that you can get back into your account if you ever get locked out, right? And so there is a lot of value in terms of the volume of user base that these companies have. And I think on the security side, we have seen a lot of that awareness and education happened because these companies built it into their products first. And so that gave billions of people frequent engagement using these types of technologies and tools from a security perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, those of us that, you know, that also work in privacy, we have to build this into our tools first. I don't think that you're not going to get feedback from, you know, the average consumer saying, I would like a privacy feature that does X, Y, and Z. What they're going to say is, these are all the things that I'm worried about or the things that scare me. And then we have to build the tool within the product and within our services so that they can become familiar with what's the behavior and what are the actions mm-hmm. that you should be taking if you have a certain worry or a certain fear.
Yeah. Certainly Facebook is the big, you know, gorilla, so we can poke at it. But it makes me think about those videos that they send out, the auto-generated, this was your year videos. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, maybe I had a really crappy year. I don't want a video with like jolly music about, you know, my pet dying or whatever horrible thing happened this year. I don't remember ever asking for those videos to be made, but I'm sure that they delight more people than they don't. But arguably, it only takes one person who had a horrible year to be reminded of a death, and then that needs to stop. Those, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, in fact, it's one of the reasons why Facebook actually does have an option for you to turn that off, so that you don't get those reminders.
Yeah, but certainly something that you would only want to turn off once it had happened once and been bad.
Right. Well, so for example, I still have the option turned on to get those end of year videos. Mm-hmm. But what I don't like are all of the frequent, like memories that they surface, because I have quite a few of them that I don't want to relive over and over again. Mm-hmm. They're an important part of my personal history and I want them to be documented and they were important experiences, but I don't need to be reminded every day.
Yeah. Certainly not on the anniversary.
Right. Exactly. And so, you know, Facebook did respond to some of that criticism for exactly what you're bringing up. Mm. I think the challenge is that it's still like an opt-out experience,
yeah.
Right? So you first have to have that really bad experience in order to know that, oh, I'm going to go turn this off, right? Mm-hmm. They don't ask you if you would like to have this before they show you the first one.
And the argument that the MBA would make, because I've worked with folks that think like this, is like, well, but only 5% or single digit percent of people will opt in, and we can get 90% if it's opt out. So clearly it's opt in by default.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, the fact that we're designing for like the 99%, I think is a problem. Mm-hmm. And it again, just goes back to, you know, like you said, the MBAs here where, you know, the people who are at the most risk from both a security perspective and a privacy perspective are not the people who are the most paranoid, right? The people who have the most to lose from insufficient security or privacy protections are not the people in the middle of your bell curve. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when we teach, you know, business school or product managers, you know, to build based on the volume of people who are going to use your product, mm-hmm. it conditions them to think about, you know, this is only valuable if a lot of people will use it. And you know what? Sometimes the products that have the biggest impact in terms of contributing to making the world a better place and actually protecting people are the tools and products that are used by small, you know, groups, on the margins of your bell curve, but it has such a massive impact on their life because of their risk profile. And, you know, these are the ways that security and privacy professionals think about it, where, you know, we envision the risk profile of all of these different groups of people who use our products. And we say, where can we have the most impact in driving down risk? And that usually happens at the edge case, not necessarily in the middle where the most people are.
Very, very powerful perspective. I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today.
Yeah, of course. Thanks again so much for the discussion. I'm always happy to talk about these topics because I'm excited to see this paradigm shifting across the industry.
We will include a link to Melanie's Twitter on the show notes. We've been talking to Melanie Ensign, the security and privacy communication lead for Uber and a frequent tweeter about sharks. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.